an oddity of Kant's account, that although he says nature is the proper locale for the sublime, he illustrates these ideas through discussions of the pyramids and St. Peter's, again, things he never saw. I take these illustrations to be less of the sublime as such than for the sake of explicating how apprehension and comprehension work in these cases. There is a primacy of nature here because art is always purposive, hence unsuitable for thinking the sublime. There must, he says, the sublime must have no purpose whatsoever of the object as the basis determining it. So the issue is one of thinking the infinite. So the crux of the mathematical sublime is the necessity of thinking the infinite. So carrying on reading where I just left off, still on page 254. The infinite, however, is absolutely large compared with everything else. Compared with it, everything else is small. And this is most important, to be able even to think the infinite as a whole indicates a mental power that surpasses any standard of sense. For thinking the infinite as a whole, while using a standard of sense, would require a comprehension yielding as a unity a standard that would have a determinate relation to the infinite, one that could be stated in numbers. And this is impossible. That is, any number is always going to be too small because you can just keep on adding to it. If nonetheless the human mind is able even to think the given infinite without contradiction, and Kant thought we could, it must have within itself a power that is supersensible, that is detachable from the powers of the imagination. And that's the same argument, just to remind you, that Descartes uses in the second meditation when he's asking the question about what is the nature of sensible objects, right? And he says, well, you know, they have... they're malleable. They can take not just this or that shape, but infinitely many shapes. And then he says, well, wait a minute. If an object can take infinitely many shapes, then our idea of an object is a rational idea. That is something not known through the senses, which is the point of the demonstration in Descartes. Got one stick. You're looking at me as if I'm nuts.
No, I'm just terrified.
Okay, you agree. Okay, so I'm not nuts, just boring. Okay. Grateful for small mercies. So that Cartesian thought is really the same thought as here. And the idea of the supersensible, he goes on to say, whose idea of a noumenon cannot be intuited, but can yet be regarded as the substrate underlying what is mere appearance, namely our intuition of the world. Allison states this argument in the following terms. He says, page 323 of Allison, he says, sublime objects, objects that are tied up with the feeling of the sublime, cannot be held in a single intuition. The objects present themselves to the imagination. I think this is a nice way of dealing with it. As if absolutely great. But to do justice to this, the starry heavens, to do justice to my experience of the starry heavens as infinite, as if therefore absolutely great, imagination seeks to produce a unit of measure adequate to the task. But the only possible measure would be the whole of nature, which is to say, the unconditioned. And that notion of the unconditioned is, that is, thinking of the whole of nature as the unconditioned, is contradictory because nature has an absolute totality. We experience only in terms of an infinite progression. So even the idea of nature as a totality is insufficient as a measure. Now, in putting it this way, Kant's thought is that the feeling produced by the mental attunement involved in entertaining the idea of the supersensible, occasioned by objects deemed to be mathematically sublime, he says, conforms to or is compatible with our moral feeling. And by that he means our sense that we have the supersensible within us, that we are more than sensible creatures. He uses the phrase conforms to or is compatible with moral feeling because he does not want to say it is a moral feeling, because if it were a moral feeling, it would not be an aesthetic response but a moral response. So he has to say it puts us in mind of our moral capacities. And in this case, it's an aesthetic response because it lacks any motivating force. It doesn't determine the will in any particular way, in the way that actual moral feelings do. So you might say that what Kant is demanding here, as he demands elsewhere, is indeed the difference between experiencing and thinking. And thinking, in the first critique, is the difference between knowing and thinking. And here it's the difference between aesthetically estimating and thinking. But in both cases, we are pushed to recognize within ourselves a non-sensible capacity. I will I'll simply flag now. When Kant talks about art, he's going to talk about art in terms of aesthetic ideas. And aesthetic ideas are sensible corollaries of intellectual ideas, and intellectual ideas are the same here as moral ideas. The question you should be asking yourself is, what on earth are aesthetic ideas? I'll have varieties of things to say about that next week. Any questions on the mathematical sublime before I press on? Okay, let us press on then to I think the more... I want to discuss first the phenomenology of sublime feeling, which he discusses in paragraph 27, and then move on to the dynamical sublime, which is, I think, more interesting and more plausible. Yeah?
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure.
It seems like Kant is really burying something when he links the imagination purely to the sensible, or he allows imagination just to represent the sensible here, when in the first critique there is this spontaneous side of the imagination. It seems like there should be something like that here operating, some kind of spontaneity of imagination. Because, I mean, the imagination doesn't simply represent what's coming into the senses, but it's also capable of recalling things from memory, and also there's a certain amount of possibly... There certainly is a spontaneous aspect to the imagination. Mm-hmm.
How would that help here?
Well, I think it would change the relationship between the imagination and the idea of reason. And
I mean, remember, that's why I mean, in a way, I tried to anticipate that worry when I took the passage from Lyotard, because he was talking exactly about the spontaneity of the imagination to keep on producing forms. But he said, even if you think of the imagination as this capacity to spin out forms, that even that capacity is going to suffer the same problem. And it's going to suffer the same problem because what it's going to do is keep producing forms.
The Gache essay on the absolutely great or whatever, absolutely large, does something like what you're saying. It says the imagination isn't just kind of under the subjection of reason. It's always kind of on the way to reason. I think that's what you're getting at. It's not just the imagination that proliferates this endlessly. It's doing it towards totality in the first place.
Right. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's what I meant, I'm sorry, by this arrow. Right? Remember I... No. Remember I said the imagination on its own would be dumb, just going on.
Right, that's
the imagination in relationship to reason, only that is counting with an ambition towards totalization. Right? So that's the imagination aspiring, not just remembering and calculating, but, as it were, trying to find forms. And one of the ways in which you can imagine the imagination doing that is shifting the quantity. So it's light years, and then, you know, you think of bigger and bigger units. Well, that's the imagination itself attempting to totalize.
I guess what I was trying to get at with the spontaneous imagination is possibly presenting something such that it's not totally infinite, but it's not a matter, certainly it wouldn't be a matter of waiting for the imagination to click towards the thing, the totality that it's trying to get at. I mean, it's kind of hard to think about sort of reason sitting around waiting, okay, imagination, you know, you're spinning along and you're not going to get it, you're cut off, you fail. And it seems more like there's some, I guess these things become like cartoon characters in my head, but maybe that's my problem. But it just seems to me that if you sort of emphasize the spontaneous possibility of imagination, then there could be something like a presentation of imagination where it's not limited by the fact that it's got this temporal structure.
Well, again, that, but then I want to know, how is it the imagination, right? Because the imagination, and this was Lyotard's point, is always going to be about another form. That is, the imagination is partially sensible, right? It's always dealing in that medium between the sensible and the non-sensible. It always has that sensible side. The sensible side is going to be form. And therefore, it's always about exhibition, presentation, the technical word that Kant gets fun with at the end is hypostasis, right? Which is just another word for Darstellung, another word for presentation. So that's the unavoidable bit of the imagination. So it is the same as the kind of Cartesian argument. You can imagine imagination being spontaneous in all sorts of ways, call that its freedom. But the imagination as freedom is bound by the sensible. And if you want to be, austere about it, the infinite is never going to be sensible. It's a pure idea.
But like going back to the Cartesian example, it sounds like we could imagine the infinite number of shapes the object can take.
That's exactly what we can't imagine.
Not the infinite number, but the fact that it could take an infinite number of shapes. I'm not saying that the imagination...
No, that's exactly, again, what we can't imagine. That's Descartes' whole point. Is that when we begin realizing that it could take an infinite number of shapes, we've stopped imagining and started reasoning. Right? That's exactly the inference that Descartes wants to make, which is why he wants to say, which sounds contradictory, right? That the concept of extended res extensa is an idea of reason, and not an idea of sense, except for the notion of resistance. It's that structure. So the freedom of the imagination will have to have another kind of role. And again, maybe in art we'll find that role. The notion of genius is going to be important there. Anything else on the mathematical sublime? Okay, paragraph 27. Kant offers a rough and readily an account of sublime feelings, and the first thing he says, which in a way might seem disappointing, is that the crucial feeling is that of respect. The feeling that is beyond our ability to attain to an idea, that is a law for us, is respect. What does that mean?
Referring to respect as he uses it in the moral philosophy, I assume.
Yep. So cash out the thought that the feeling that is beyond our ability to attain an idea, that is a law for us, is respect. What is he trying to get at there?
To be in awe.
And why would we be in awe of it? And therefore, why feel respect? I mean, I'm just trying to unpack the logic here. I'm not trying to be mysterious. Yeah?
So can we just maybe flip that to understand? So I'm in awe because it humbles me. So because I'm...
Okay, why does it humble you?
For moral law. I think about the Monty Python prairie god. Oh, you're so very big, we're very impressed.
Okay. But it's not that. So that's why I'm kind of interested in it. That it's not because that would be the dynamical sublime, right? And interestingly enough, in the Bible we know that they don't distinguish in the Old Testament. They don't distinguish. I think I'm right about this. Fear from obey. I see that you are, or will obey the Lord, or you will fear the Lord. It's the same word, right? Now that's what Kant's trying to avoid. He wants the notion of respect to be without the notion of, right, Joe?
I was later as above, and specifically talk about religions, barbaric religions that make you bow and scrape before God without understanding.
Right.
And about ethicists about barbarians who only fear God, and so it can't be about that kind of subjugating.
Right.
Of respect, they're more of a sort of
self-subjugation. It's an a priori self. It's not a pathological feeling. It's an a priori feeling where you subjugate to yourself, to your own highest being, your personality. Which is
mm-hmm.
I think later on he uses the word vocation, mm-hmm. like our vocation to be in nature but not of it,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's respect for work in a sense for what. Human beings, worker, fate might be.
Sure. I mean, I think all that's right. I guess I'm struck here, important for Kant is the notion of law here. This is the law of our will, and therefore it's an ideal that has normative authority. So, in recognizing that the moral law is that, so it commands that, treat everyone as an end in themselves, or if they are an end in themselves, as the law of my will, right? The reason that we can never attain it is precisely because it is an ideal norm, right? That is precisely that which remains a norm and authoritative for us, and therefore we can asymptotically approach it by trying to conform to it, but it stands above us. And in recognizing it stands above us, that's what it is to feel respect. The feeling of respect is the feeling appropriate to something that you acknowledge as the law of your will. Okay, so he's using so it's the idea of normative authority that's doing a lot of the work here. And the idea of normative authority as something that can only be such if it is law-like, something that is always independent of your will and a guide for it. So that's our idea of reason, the supersensible within us. And it's so it's respect for our own vocation, because it's respect for the fact that we are, and the are is important, we are rational self-determining. That is, we have the power to act in accordance with norms. This notion of ideality is what is incommensurable with any sensible presentation. Because any sensible presentation will not be it, but at best, it's not just an instance of it, but something that, because that's always universal in particular, but an instance of it with respect to its authority. So it's the authoritative character of something that is normatively ideal, a priori for the will, that is doing the work here. And that, for Kant, is our reason. That is, reason is our capacity to be moved by a pure idea. So the notion of respect is the thought that we are intrinsically motivated by our apprehension of this to act in accordance with it. We also, just to remind you, have another spring of motivation, desire, which is, you know, which is right. That's, you know, there's like the little devils on either shoulder. Moral law here, sensibility here, you know, and you kind of go like this. You hope that the, you know, the little devil wins. But it's respect is that feeling of the feeling in relationship to that rational authority. Okay. So the sublime feeling is a feeling that refers to that rational vocation, and a rational vocation that means that we are not to be determined or governed by anything sensible. That ultimately our actions are to be determined by the moral law itself, hence by reason itself. This is why Kant thinks of the notion of the sublime as a subreption. That is, we think we are respecting nature, but really it is our own rational vocation. But certain objects are capable of occasioning such a feeling. Now, and I guess someone asked about this at the break. This is the big difference between the beautiful and the sublime. That is, in the case of the sublime, the object is an occasion which sets off in me my coming to awareness of my rational vocation. And certain objects are more or less suitable for doing that, right? Say the starry heavens. But it is, I want to underline the thought that in this case, the object is an occasion, which is the sense that the object, in a way, almost drops out. That the object has a less intrinsic role to play. And it's because the object has a less intrinsic role to play here that Kant feels he does not have to offer a deduction of the sublime. After all, what would a deduction of the sublime be? If the object is an occasion for me being aware of what I am rationally certain I possess anyway, then all I have to do is elaborate the situation in the right way, and we understand the sublime. It's justified or deduced. He doesn't actually have to do anything more, because the appropriate feeling is just the pain, pleasure, and it turns out the pleasure itself is a pleasure in what we can already feel, as it were, good about. Namely, that we are rational, self-determined creatures. Hence, Kant says that there is no deduction of the sublime. Its exposition is the same as its deduction. Yeah, Joe?
Sense in which the sublime is not potentially everywhere. By these potential objects restricted, but easier for that? Is that part of
it? Well, he doesn't think easier. He actually later on, especially with respect to the mathematical sublime, he says, well, in fact, we ought to be worried about this, in fact, you'd better be a morally cultured person if you're going to really appreciate the dynamically sublime. So it's your moral education that prepares you to, when you come across, why would you come across them? Why would you seek them out? I mean, there are questions I want to answer about why the sublime. Because, after all, the sublime, in a way, tells us what we already know. So why are we interested in it? There's a puzzle here.
That's also easier in a sense because it's a problem of, a problem of culture and a problem that's intrinsic within our mode of reporting towards the world.
Right.
You certainly want to start solving the first one
right.
rather than the second. So it's a different kind of, it's a different level of problem.
That's right.
And he talks later as well in terms of our attempts to find the supply.
That's right.
So again, it's
We kind of seek it out because, well, again, that's where we have to figure out why do we seek it out. Yeah.
Does that mean we can be educated to appreciate the sublime in a way that we couldn't be to appreciate the beautiful?
Well, of course, in both cases, the notion of education in both cases is complicated. But you're, I guess, right to say that if you, if we educate someone, if someone is morally educated, then we should be able to get them to appreciate the sublime. That seems right. Once they have the moral equipment, they should be able to have the aesthetic equipment. Now, Kant gives a variety of curious descriptions of the actual feelings themselves. At 258, he says, in presenting the sublime in nature, the mind feels agitated. While in aesthetic judgment of the beautiful in nature, it is in restful contemplation. This agitation, above all at its inception, can be compared with a vibration, i.e. with a rapid alternation of repulsion from and attraction to one and the same object. If a thing is excessive for the imagination is driven to such an excess as it apprehends the thing in intuition, then the thing is, as it were, an abyss in which the imagination is afraid to lose itself. It moves from the abyss, yet at the same time, the reason's idea of the supersensible is not excessive, but conforms to reason's law to give rise to such striving by the imagination. That's the law you were talking about before. Hence, the thing is now attractive to the same degree to which it formerly was repulsive to mere sensibility. Okay, now, on the next page, he talks about simultaneity. which is to say Kant seems to give two different descriptions of the sublime feeling. On the one occasion, he thinks of the sublime feeling as one complex feeling in which the imagination is humiliated and at the same time, in the same experience of engagement, we feel this excessive pleasure. So one version of the sublime is one unified complex feeling. A second notion of the sublime is presented as a series of individual feelings, and in which first the imagination feels pain, then there's some sort of rational insight, and then it feels pleasure. In his article on the sublime, Guire, I think, plausibly argues that the reason Kant is tempted by the second account, that's called the serial account, is because he is very often persuaded by Hume's theories of feelings. And for Hume, feelings have to be, especially pleasure, each of them have to be atomic and unmixed. And there's ways in which Kant is often inheriting empiricist ideas and then trying to do things with them that they can't quite manage. And I think this is a case in which he knows that what he wants is really to try to think about a complex emotional experience, say affective experience that has these cognitive dimensions, but his inclinations toward empiricist accounts of the feelings and emotions leads him to overly simplify. So if you want to think about the sublime feeling, it's probably more plausible if one tries to construct it as indeed something like what he suggests at the beginning, a negative pleasure. That is a pleasure that is bound up with an experience of the negative being surmounted as a component of that feeling.
Yeah. When Hume talks about pain, he's talking about a kind of discomfort or uneasiness. Is Kant using pain in that sense also, or is it a different kind of like an actual hurt?
No, I think it's the discomfort, uneasiness, inability, and then he'll use analogous terms, humiliation of violence to the experience of limitation and the like. It is also worth remembering, just one last thought on before we move to the dynamic, that the moral law itself, the notion of respect for the moral law, is complicated and in fact contradictory. And the contradictoriness is kind of obvious. The moral law has to actually do two separate tasks effectively. It has to humiliate the desires, that is, has to humble us, and it has to represent an ideal to be striven after. So it actually goes in two different directions. One direction is the slamming down and the hammering of the desires, and the other is presenting itself as an object of ideal fascination, which is to say, if you are Freudian, you might want to say it is both a superego, right? So don't do this, don't do that, I'm your dad, you listen to me, and an ego ideal. that is, that which you want to be at the same time. And there's a lot of, not a lot of literature, but if you think hard about it, Kant can't really count for the double structure of the moral law. But it's worth remembering, I mean, the reason I mention it here is the experience of the moral law, if I'm right, it includes both the pain of humiliation and the pleasure of desire, itself has a complicated, the notion of respect, in fact, encapsulates itself a complicated pleasure-pain structure. That's my thought, and my hunch is that it's because he intuitively had that thought of what the moral law does that he found it so easy to paste it on to the structure of the sublime. Okay, the dynamically sublime, paragraph 28. Well, this is the sublime as we're more familiar with it, but also the sublime in ways that raises all those questions that we've been skirting around. This considers nature not in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality, and in particular in terms of might, in terms of the power of nature. Now, in aesthetic responses to large mountains and roaring waterfalls and these other sites of the dynamically sublime, we are overawed, but we are and cannot be literally afraid, for an aesthetic response would be impossible if we were actually fearful of the object. Because when we're afraid, we're not going to appreciate anything. We're just going to run. So, and here's the puzzle. It's the experience of nature as fearful, as an object capable of inciting fear, and in a way experienced as fearful, without actually being afraid. Now, what separates actual fear from what I'm calling the fearful is that in the perception of a true object of fear, one would be aware that any resistance would be futile. Which is to say that in seeing something as truly fearful, we have to recognize our physical impotence. What makes an aesthetic perception of all this possible is that we experience this might from a safe place, from a safe distance. So, Kant says, just an example, 261, on the other hand, consider bold overhanging and, as it were, threatening rocks, thunderclouds piling up in the sky and moving about, accompanied by lightning and thunderclaps, volcanoes, he never saw any, with all their destructive power, hurricanes with all their devastation they leave behind, the boundless ocean heaved up, the high waterfall of a mighty river, and so on. Compared to the might of any of these, our ability to resist becomes an insignificant trifle. Yet the sight of them becomes all the more attractive. Attractive. The more fearful it is. Provided we are in a safe place. And we like to call these objects sublime because they raise the soul's fortitude above its usual middle range and allow us to discover in ourselves an ability to resist, which is of a quite different kind and which gives the courage to believe that we could be a match for nature's seeming omnipotence. So, aesthetic distance from nature is distance from its immediate threat. But what is so viewed is nature in its immense power and in its indifference to us. That is, what we become aware of, in this case, really is nature as utterly a disenchanted and terrifying place, and hence what we become aware of is our mortality and thereby our finitude. Now, physical nature is necessary but not sufficient for Kant, because our physical independence from this threat gets translated into a moral independence from nature. So he says at the end of page 61, in the same way, though the irresistibility of nature's might makes us considered as natural things, recognize our physical impotence, it reveals in us at the same time an ability to judge ourselves independent of nature and reveals in us a superiority over nature that is the basis of a self-preservation quite different in kind from the one that can be assailed and endangered by nature outside us. Take it our capacity to preserve ourselves as moral beings. That so at the very last paragraph of the section, he says, sublimity is contained not in anything in nature, but only in our mind, insofar as we can become conscious of our superiority to nature within us, and thereby also to nature outside us, as far as it influences us. Whatever arouses this feeling in us, and this includes the might of nature that challenges our forces, is then, although improperly called sublime, and it is only by presupposing this idea within us, and by referring to it, that we can arrive at the sublimity of that being who arouses deep respect in us, etc., etc. Well, this is puzzling, but the puzzle here, I think, is deeper than, for me at least, deeper than the puzzle with respect to the mathematical sublime, because I think we're all aware of this nature of the sublime. And somehow the Kantian account approximates something. Without quite being satisfied. And I want to offer two hypotheses about the nature of the dynamical sublime to try to account for this. I think the first account I want to offer is to try to think about the sublime in terms, after all, the puzzle is, why do we seek to put ourselves in relationship to things that terrify us? What is that about? And I want to at least answer this in the first way by drawing an analogy between the dynamical sublime and tragedy. So my thought would work like this, that, I mean, after all, tragedy has a, as you know, in Aristotle, according to Aristotle, has a pity, fear, catharsis structure. And I take it the pity, fear, catharsis structure is, I want to claim, analogous to the pain, pleasure structure of the sublime. And it seems to me interesting, more than interesting, that at the time that the sublime arose, tragedy had almost disappeared from European literature. Had disappeared for all intents and purposes. There was drama, but the notion of tragedy had sort of gone away. Well, let's start then with the question, why do we go to tragedies? Maybe that will help. And the response I find most compelling is one offered by Jonathan Lear in an article on catharsis that appears in Omni Rorty's reader on Aristotle's Poetics. And Lear says that normal educated people in normal circumstances and outside of the theater seem to have beliefs they do not feel. And this is really, for me, going to be the heart of the matter. That we all have numerous beliefs about our lives which we have, if you wish, intellectually but not effectively. For example, you're going to die. We don't live in constant dread, although Heidegger would like us to, in constant dread that we're going to die. We don't ordinarily feel that we are, if we have children, we are, we believe that they are vulnerable and we want to protect them, but we can't live in perpetual anxiety about that, et cetera, et cetera. We have lots of beliefs for which we do not normally have the appropriate feelings. Lear's hypothesis is that when such people experience a good tragedy, they are able to unify their beliefs with the emotions appropriate to them. And I simply take, and I'd want to argue, that this thought extends beyond tragedy to, I think, much of art. That is, I think much of art is about the reconnecting of our cognitive life with our doxic life, with our affective life. Now, what makes it possible for us to do this, of course, is being in, if you wish, a safe place, in the theater. And in the theater, what a dramatist can do is take states of affairs that would generate the appropriate emotions and treat them as if they were real, or at least possibly real. So the thought about the events in a good tragedy, Lear says, he says, even if tragedy does not befall us, it goes to the root of the human condition that it is a possibility we must live with. So the sorts of situations that are rehearsed in tragedies are ones that are related to some of our fundamental beliefs about who we are as human beings. And they take those beliefs and give us the opportunity to experience them. Catharsis occurs, according to Lear, when we feel we have experienced the worst in reality or in imagination and survived. Our survival, which is guaranteed when we have experienced the worst only imaginably, is what permits the release of our pent-up emotions. Having survived and appreciating our survival, we have nothing further to fear. There is, Lear says, consolation in realizing that one has experienced the worst, there is nothing further to fear, and yet the world remains a rational and meaningful place in which a person can conduct himself with dignity. Even in tragedy, perhaps especially in tragedy, the fundamental goodness of man and the world are reaffirmed. I don't think I believe that last bit. But it would be a... I suspect that Lear probably does, and I think that Aristotle does, which is why I think Lear is saying it. But I think it's a bad description of tragedy. Nonetheless, the catharsis does seem to me to have something to do with having experience the feelings appropriate to those beliefs and experience that we can survive them. Right? So we are drawn to those tragedies, those types of art in which there is, and it's interesting, in Aristotle, the word pathos actually is both objective and subjective. And objective pathos is the occasion, the type of structure of situation that can threaten a subject. And the subjective pathos is the fear and anxiety occasioned by a situation like that. So for Aristotle, the idea is there has to be an appropriate situation. That is, the tragedy must be plausible. It must be something that occurred for individuals for the most part. All that language in Aristotle about how the narratives work is really to try to argue for an objective pathos that generates the subjective pathos, the fear and pity. How about the sublime? Well, I think like tragedy, sublimity is to be understood as precisely a relationship between an objective pathos, in this case, a greatness in size or intensity threatening our sensible being by the measure of our body. And a subject of pathos, namely fear and anxiety. The scene, although dramatic in itself, is no longer a drama. Which is to say, it's no longer a series of actions. It is not characters we observe in the sublime, but ourselves. But nonetheless, I want to insist on it being a kind of drama. And we are both audience and hero in one. This is why pity drops out of the formula. We don't have to pity ourselves. We don't have to identify with ourselves. We are ourselves. There is no one's downfall we have to empathize with. However, the movement is directly from a safely observed threat to the recognition of rational safety and the catharsis of pleasure. Then the obvious question is, if this analogy is right, what happened to the action? Here's my guess. And this is just a guess. As in tragedy, I think in the sublime, we seek out reassurance that the world is a rational place through contrast with threatening nature. A threatening nature which has been mastered and left behind in the emergence of bourgeois society. Now, in saying this, and I take it that this is this is what I, the reason I mentioned Schiller earlier when I said he thinks the seduction is beauty. Let's say the seduction that makes us forget threatening nature is bourgeois society. That in bourgeois society, we no longer face nature as a large and threatening thing. Rather, bourgeois society is a kind of world that supports and protects individuals and therefore dulls the need for significant action. The more rational and orderly society is, the less individual action is required to bear the burden of our standing in the world. That all we have to do is do what society requires of us. Indeed, in the modern world, significant action is usually considered to be part of situations that are intimate, tactful, a question of manners or strategy, at any rate, the sort of thing you get in a novel. On the other hand, this orderly and rational world is already beginning to feel flat, small, incapable of presenting in its own terms anything that might be said to go to the root of the human condition. That is, if you wish, think of what Heidegger calls the world of das Mann, what Mill thinks of the world of habit, what Kierkegaard thought of as Christendom. I mean, I could go on and on, including for Kant, the bourgeois world is a world of imitative rules in which we forget those features of experience that are constitutive of it. As Adorno puts the thought, he says, the subject's powerlessness in society is petrified into a second nature, which promotes the motor of flight into purportedly first nature. That is, I think the sublime is the reason people go into the woods for a hike, the reason that we seek out waterfalls, the reason why when the hurricane is lashing outside, do we hover inside? No, I want to go outside into that howling 100-mile-an-hour wind. Why? Because I want an experience that literally goes to the root of my condition as a natural being. So my thought is that in the case of the sublime reaches past the complacent narcissism of the everyday in order to allow us to measure and sense society as a whole and us in it as composed still of mortal and vulnerable beings triumphing over hostile nature. So the original sublime, the sublime as it's thought about in Burke and Kant, I believe, was culture's first attempt, or the first need to make an attempt, to find a limit to rational order that would reanimate the subject. That is, I take it that there really is here, we desire the sublime that might destroy us as a reminder of our natural mortality. And we want a reminder of our natural mortality not because we want to die, but because we want reminder of what it is that we are alive. That is, we want to be able to feel our sensible aliveness in relationship to the conditions that make it pertinent. So that we seek the sublime in order to have the feelings appropriate to our beliefs about ourselves as vulnerable, injurable, mortal beings. I cannot think of any other reason why we would seek it out. Now, Kant wants a more complicated thought. He thinks we want to seek it out because we want reassurance of ourselves as self-conscious creatures. Let me stop there. Yeah.
As far as on your account, would you think of the sublime, to what extent would the sublime have to be a solitary experience for you?
I think it would be, which is why I think we're always disappointed, like, go to Niagara Falls, right? And you're there, and no matter how you go through it, if you're part of a party walking through, you know, with the guide and everything, it doesn't have the same zing to it.
Is there something about, like...
Which is why, I was in Yellowstone... Course, the first thing I wanted to do was to get off the path. What I really wanted to do was get lost. Yeah. I wanted to be in danger. But not absolute danger. I want to go way off the path.
Keep your cell phone.
Right? I only just got a cell phone. So anyway. So that's part. Yeah?
Can I just follow up?
Follow up, yeah.
It seemed like the kind of narcissism is the blind also. This sort of like going out for the walk in the woods where it's like the woods is so much larger than me, but I'm also just focused on this experience.
absolutely, I'm not denying the narcissism. I'm certainly thinking that there's a kind of unavoidability, that I am placing the structure of the sublime, I'm historicizing it as a part of a type of response to a particular bourgeois culture, which is a culture of a kind of narcissism, for sure.
So I stayed on this side of bourgeois humanism.
On this side of?
Like bourgeois humanism.
Yeah, sure.
So I think. The same place.
I think so, yeah.
It's just such a waste, though. We're almost at a great idea.
Well, we'll see if we can jack it up. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, my question had to do with that safe place and what role that plays in your account. Because it seems like Kant wouldn't really want to go into that hurricane. You might want to watch it from a safe window pane.
Well, the notion of safe places is relative, right? No one's going out. No one's going out into the thunderstorm in order to die, right? We want just enough exposure, right, for it to feel. So the question is, you know, and I take it that what we call, you know, the wilderness idea now is a certain ramping up of what used to be the gentlemanly sublime. Let us go, my dear, and walk to the waterfalls. Whoa, they're big and powerful. That's fine, you know. And then the next guy says, you know, I'm going out in the wood, you know, and I'm going to
propel down the water.
That's right. That's what I'm going to do. Boom. Right? I'm okay, right? So bungee jump. All this kind of crazy stuff people do. Something like that, I think. Now, yeah?
I thought you were done your idea. I was going to ask about the relationship between dynamic and mathematics.
Right.
And also moving into like Kant's use of dynamic mathematical and first critique.
Yeah. So my thought is that the mathematical sublime, on my reading, is actually a version of the dynamical sublime. So my sense is, you know, when in the Midwest or, you know, anyway, out of the city and out of the suburbs, when I look at the sky and I find it awesome, it's because I have a sense of immensity, where that notion of immensity is the quantitative as qualitative, right? So it's that sense, oh yeah, that's really big. I mean, you know, and that's, again, that sense finally of being exposed to it.
There's a threat involved in that bigness?
There's a feeling of radical diminishment of me. So it's a different kind of threat. It's the threat that Pascal felt on the basis of the new science. But we don't even, I mean, Pascal just got it immediately. I think for us to get that sense of what it means to live in an infinite universe, you know, the story from closed world to infinite universe, we are born into an infinite universe and rarely feel it. And in fact, our fundamentalist friends think it's a closed world. So that notion of infinite universe doesn't have an effective grip. And I think those are occasions where the notion of an infinite universe gets an effective grip. That's the way I think of it. Yeah. And then,
but then, yeah, I'm just curious about the last moment of this experience of mortal and vulnerable beings triumphing over hostile nature. The triumphing over hostile nature part doesn't necessarily seem to me to be a part of the phenomenology of the experience. I mean, the experience that you just talked about in terms of scale and the shift in scale when you feel, in fact, quite small. I think it's really important, but I don't see how that then immediately flips into some kind of moral grandeur or sort of rationalism.
No. Remember, I'm
or,
no.
So your job
I will come back to that after next week. I'm doing the feeling alive line rather than the moral grandeur line or rational self-assurance line. And I'll then have to ask how Kant takes what I'm taking to be the narrative structure and translate it into an account of self-reassurance. I have a story to tell about that, but they're two different stories, for sure. Adam?
I don't know if this is the same question, or I guess it's at least related to the one Pam just asked, but it seems to me that the sublime gives us a kind of mirror image of what for Kant is our divided nature, that is, our sensible finitude and our rational rational being is something different in kind mm-hmm. than nature. So that, I mean, as you just pointed out, is very different than the account you just gave
right.
of finding a limit to the rational order and reaffirming a kind of secure finitude
absolutely.
That somehow does not require rationalization.
Right.
So.
You almost say the mirror images of one another, aren't they?
Yeah. The so yeah. I think there's a perfectly anodyne response to why Kant wanted to do it his way rather than yours, which is he has a dualistic conception of our nature.
Sure.
But at a deeper level, I find that unsatisfying. That is, why is Kant keeping rationality in the picture? What does that add?
Well, what I'll try to convince you of next week is it's actually a story about the emergence of self-consciousness. But I'm going to leave that as a hint. How can we think of the sublime as the scene of the emergence of self-consciousness you grab? Okay, let's